Good morning and welcome to my lecture on Charlotte Mason in the 21st century. The vision for the Charlotte Mason Institute is to foster a relational education by equipping and inspiring communities through current applications of Charlotte Mason's principles. The goal is to do this through such values as charity, fidelity, and humility. The question is, what does it mean to equip and inspire communities through a current application of Charlotte Mason's principles? What does a current application look like? A current application could not just mean looking back to Mason and the Victorian science of her day and making a current use of her principles without any discussion of what current science is teaching us. First, let me say that the Institute has committed itself to thoroughly understanding Mason. Second, this requires a lot of work over a long period of time. We are not finished yet. It will not be done in a day. It will take years. Nor, and please excuse my cheekiness, will it be done through supposedly open and honest conversations on social media. There is still a place for scholarly work on a topic such as Mason's educational theories and practices that needs to be done. And what scholarly work really means is just plain hard work digging as deep as we can into Mason, her Victorian context, and a continual look at current science. I know there are those that do not appreciate scholarly work and view it as ivory tower behavior, but it is this serious scholarly work that helps us understand Mason in her context and what the implications are for today. Not only do we need to consider Mason in the 21st century, but we need to reconsider the James 3 passage related to the responsibilities of teachers. I do not have time to do that in this talk, but it must be considered carefully in any educational paradigm. It will have to be a lecture for another day. I want to put what I say today about bringing Mason into the 21st century into three parts. In the first part, I look at some ideas that I believe are necessary for us to consider in order to bring Mason into the 21st century. In part two, I discuss some of the beliefs and practices of Mason that I believe are important today as they were when Mason wrote them. Then in part three, I consider another aspect of Mason, Charlotte Mason as a poet, that we must not forget. I do not mean Mason as the writer of poetry, but a Charlotte Mason who takes us beyond the obvious. I want to say at the outset of this journey that while we consider this hard work or scholarly work that I have already mentioned about Mason for the 21st century, let us also remember that we owe much to the many educators who have gone before us. As Mason said, we stand on the shoulders of men and women who have studied children and educational theories for centuries, trying to figure out how to educate children. It really does not become us if we belie and denigrate the people who have worked very hard and have come before us, even if we disagree with some of their ideas and outcomes. In fact, if we really listen to Mason, instead of assuming she was the perfect educator and that God finished all that he had to say about education with her death in 1923, we will understand that she is now among those whose shoulders we stand on. And I believe this includes the educators who have been seeking to understand how to educate children since Mason's time. We stand on their shoulders. It cannot be that anything important related to education stopped in 1923 when she died. God has nothing else to tell us? I happen to believe that Mason has done an excellent job on so many fronts, but I also believe that she would be aghast to think that all educational endeavors since her time were meaningless. Now, there are some that are meaningless. In fact, I've experienced some that are meaningless. But there are many, many that have given us good insight into teaching and learning. In fact, I think that there are some questions about Mason that I believe need to be explored more deeply. For example, how can we move Mason into the 21st century when she based much of her knowledge about teaching and learning on mid-1800s studies of the brain? How many of us would like to go to a current doctor who bases his medical practices on those from the 1800s? Did she understand the final truth about education when she declared that her theories are natural or divine law, thus making them unquestionable? Is it even possible for a human to make such a claim? Mason died in 1923. Have we not learned anything in almost 100 years? For example, mega studies in the learning of mathematics have been completed. Are we not to review and learn from them? Would she not do that? Such studies were not available or possible during her time. There have been many studies in the development of language in children. Would she have read these? Absolutely she would, and she would be on top of what they were indicating for the teaching of children. She would engage in the current discussion among the leading educators of her day. And if they didn't listen, she would write to the Times or to a newspaper, which she frequently did to get her voice heard. Are we to look only at the current studies to see where they agree or disagree with Mason and essentially learn nothing from them because we refuse to accept any new learning, therefore thinking that nothing new could possibly have been discovered about education? Has neuroscience nothing to say to us that we may learn from? I can promise you Charlotte Mason would learn from this new science work, and she would modify her methods if there was a need to modify them. Or is this whole conversation about Mason in the 21st century just about allegiance to Mason, or should it be about truth, especially truth that directs us in the teaching of children? In other words, is what we do the same as what she did, for the children's sake? Or is it about some allegiance to Mason making our work today for Mason's sake? Can we as an institute legitimately claim that we tell the truth about teaching and learning if we don't research and dig into every aspect of Mason's philosophy and practices and into current science and psychology? If we listen and look into Mason more carefully and deeply, I think she herself provides an answer for us. Listen to what she says. But his commandment, meaning God, is exceeding broad, becomes broader year by year with every revelation of science, and we had need gird up the loins of our minds to keep pace with this current revelation. We shall be at pains, too, to keep ourselves in that attitude of expectant attention, wherein we shall be enabled to perceive the unity and continuity of this revelation with that of the written word of God. For perhaps it is only as we are able to receive the two and harmonize the two in a willing and obedient heart that we shall enter on the heritage of glad and holy living, which is the will of God for us. And that comes from Parents and Children, page 21 and 22. I can make three immediate observations from this quote. One, Mason was clearly a non-Platonic thinker. Two, she was not afraid to tackle current thought. 3. Her belief in God and her Savior Jesus the Messiah was so strong that very little rattled her. She, in fact, girded up the loins of her mind to keep pace with this current revelation. In the 1950s, in educational psychology, there was a cognitive revolution, and now we are in the midst of a new neuroscience revolution. Are we not to gird up the loins of our minds and seek to understand what these two sciences are teaching us? Or are we just to look back to the Victorian era? As these two fields of science or educational psychology progress, we are learning a huge amount about the brain and our minds. What does this new science tell us, and how are we to apply it to current educational thought and to Mason's educational thought? Are we to ignore it and to just live in the Victorian era? Not according to Charlotte Mason. In fact, we are not doing Mason if we ignore the new knowledge. So I ask, what is the way forward to bring Mason into the 21st century? Because I submit to you that we have not done that yet. What we have done is just look at her theories and practices and applied them directly to our children. It is not sufficient to think that we can do exactly as Mason described in her books without looking at current science. We have not done that, and in fact, those of us who have begun the process are sometimes blackballed as people who are not worthy for others to listen to. We cannot simply study Mason and do exactly as she said and think that is bringing Mason into the 21st century. In fact, I believe she would be appalled at such an idea. We must admit to ourselves that God, through science, continues to reveal himself to us. We are not capable of understanding all knowledge of God at one time. We are simply too finite to be able to do so. Thus, science must continue to reveal more and more of the knowledge of God. There are three things, at least, that I believe we must do. 1. Dig deeper into Mason and her context, far beyond what social media will allow. 2. We must gird up the loins of our minds and dig deeper into current science. And 3. Dig deeper into the Holy Scriptures and retain a strong biblical view of life. We must do at least these three in order to move forward. Let me discuss for a moment what I mean by digging deeper into Mason and her context. One of the ways that we can understand Mason more deeply and fully is to situate her within the Victorian and Edwardian eras in which she lived and worked. Let me give you an example from Scripture as to why this is important. In ancient Rome, the eldest living male had absolute authority over all people in his family, including his wife, sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters, slaves, the children of slaves. What he said was the family law. No questions asked. Now listen to what Paul spoke into that culture. Be subject to one another out of reverence for the Messiah. With this passage from Ephesians 5:21, Paul is aiming at a radically different family structure, one based on relationship rather than what the Roman culture had produced. Do you get the sense of how radical Paul's perspective is? If we judge his comments from our vantage point, it loses its power and significance. We have to go back inside the Greco-Roman world to understand the significance of Paul's statement. Thus, we cannot translate Mason using today's understandings. We must go back and understand what she believed and why she believed it based on her context, not our context. Until we have done that, We haven't done our job. In fact, what we have done is proof text Mason. What is proof texting? Proof texting is the idea of using a text for one's own purposes without acknowledging the context from which the text comes. In other words, if we proof text Mason, we have quoted from her to prove what we want to prove without looking at the original context to make sure we understand from her context what she means. And even then, we cannot understand what was in her mind. We can only interpret. But to try to interpret without understanding thoroughly her context is wrong. When we study Mason in the context of her time, we will get a more thorough understanding of who Mason is, what were her views on various topics, where her ideas came from, who truly influenced her ideas. This understanding can give us insight into Mason's understanding of theories such as the rut theory. We know today that there is no rut theory about the development of the brain. Mason's belief was that if we get a child early and develop those ruts in the brain, then we can make the child into what we wanted to. She based this on the latest science of her day, but today we know that this isn't true. For example, we can just try to change the ruts in an autistic child's brain forever, and he or she will remain autistic. Another example is habits. Practicing habits does not create ruts in the brain. It appears, based on some research at MIT, that brain cells may chunk together based on repeated action and eventually form a beginning to the chunk and an end to the chunk. When you repeatedly work through the chunk, it can become automated. This is why you can leave your house to go to work or to the grocery store, and the next thing you realize is that you are sitting in the parking lot. You don't remember anything in the middle. How did that happen? Your chunk of neurons were firing for you, and this chunk has become automated. This is different than the rut theory. So the questions we must answer are, how are habits formed, maintained, and modified? What can become a habit? And does the formation of habit work the same for all people? What happens if we want to develop a habit and the child's brain has not matured enough? What are the benefits of habits? Mason was correct. There are certain benefits from habits that we all need. As N.T. Wright points out in his book, After You Believe, we are all very thankful that Sullenberger had practiced landing an airplane in various situations, that he knew exactly what to do when he had to land the plane on the Hudson River after taking off from a New York airport headed to Charlotte. But we must explore these questions now with the new knowledge that we have about habit formation, because we now know that some things that Mason thought could be trained by habit cannot be trained by habit. It is based on brain chemistry and brain maturity. We can do this with knowledge. We cannot do this with knowledge from the Victorian era. Habits are important, but we cannot make a child into what we want them to be by simple habit formation. In fact, through letters to Henrietta Franklin, we know that Mason had begun to doubt the rut theory for habit training. Even she was having problems with it. Another point, if we only proof text Mason, we began to cast this aura around her. The consequences of that is that she cannot be human, nor can she be wrong. We began to marbleize her, and we will eventually turn her into a marbleized statue rather than a person whose ideas are still living. In other words, I can turn Mason into a goddess and claim through proof texting how she got everything correct and essentially raise her to the level of an inspired divine writer, and ultimately destroy her livingness as an educator. Mason, I believe, would be horrified with such an idea. I said I would address the first two things that needed to be done. One, dig deeper into Mason, and two, dig deeper into the current science. Well, why should we dig deeper into current science? Here again, Mason gives us a way forward. She says, but alas, psychologies are many and educational denominations are bitterly opposed to one another. We must feel our way to some test by which we can discern a working psychology for our own age. The emphasis there is mine. For, like all science, she goes on to say, psychology is progressive. And I just want to insert here, don't misunderstand her use of the word progressive. It is not a political progressive that she is referring to, but rather the idea that science continues to teach us. She goes on to say, what worked even 50 years ago will not work today. And what fulfills our needs today will not serve 50 years hence. There is no last word to be said upon education. It evolves with the evolution of the race. That comes from School Education, page 45. We have a responsibility to study both Mason and current theories of science. We cannot bring Mason into the 21st century with the dignity and respect that she deserves without understanding the science of our day and how it informs our practice. We then must bring these, meaning Mason and current science, into alignment or misalignment with what we know about Scripture. These three streams must come together. If any of Mason's theories do not line up appropriately, then we must examine it in detail to make sure that it is accurate. To do less than that is to misinform parents and teachers. An example of current science that significantly makes an impact on education is the current studies in neuroscience. We are learning more and more about how the brain works almost on a daily basis. I can guarantee you that if Mason were living today, she would be in the middle of reading this material and understanding how it would change teaching and learning. All that we have learned about the neuroatypical child in the last 30 years is amazing. Are we to ignore this new learning? No, Mason wouldn't. She would be in the middle of the discussion, if not leading the way, as she led the way during her time. Another example that current science is teaching us. We have several memory systems, not just one, as many thought in Mason's time. We must gird up the loins of our minds and do the work necessary to understand how these memory systems make an impact on teaching and learning. If we don't, then we are not doing Mason. I want to summarize a bit in this portion of my lecture. We must study Mason in her general cultural context of the Victorian era, in her science context, meaning her psychological context, her educational context, and more, to understand where her theories come from. Two, we must also study what current science is revealing, as Mason told us. We cannot cling to outdated and immature science from the 1800s as though Mason could possibly have gotten everything about education correct based on that science. She didn't claim to. She clearly said, what worked even 50 years ago will not work today, and what fulfills our needs today will not serve 50 years hence. There is no last word to be said upon education. It evolves with the evolution of the race. As with Mason, our faith must be so strong that the new science does not rattle us. We can engage with it, examine it, and discover whether or not it is valid. Now let's move to part two, which is where I want to deal with some of Mason's principles that we hold dear and that we are not willing to let go of. These are principles that will also help guide us into the future, deeper into the 21st century. I only want to highlight some that I think are exceptional and life-changing. Please understand that as I mention these principles, they are all lectures within and of themselves. But I'm only devoting a paragraph or two about each. And also, please understand that I'm leaving out some principles just because I cannot cover everything in this lecture. Let's begin with her founding principle and the principle upon which everything in her philosophy and pedagogy are based, and that is, the child is a born person. What are some of the characteristics that identify us as persons? It tells us that the child is generative, relational, has an innate ability to use language. It tells us that the child changes from within and not without. You see, if you go back to her context, you will discover that this was a major shift in educational thought, and Mason helped to lead the way. Until her time, memorizing was the main learning tool, which came out of a very old and stale learning system, and even a newer system developed just before her time called the Montessorial system. She understood how meaningless these systems were, particularly in their effort to change children from without rather than from within. Just these two or three indicators of personhood, that is, children are generative, relational, they change from within, they have an ability or an innate ability to use language. These ideas created a radical change in the way we approach teaching and learning, as opposed to the prevailing educational practice of her day. Her first or founding principle should always be our founding principle. We can never let go of it. There is much more to be said about these ideas related to personhood, and unfortunately, I do not have time. Let us move to another principle. The literary form. Isn't it interesting how we talk about story, and some have claimed that we are story? This one, interestingly, has been borne out in modern research on the narrative and its importance in our lives. The importance of the literary form has also been borne out in the studies from neuroscience. The world-class educational psychologist Jerome Bruner wrote about it in his book, Acts of Meaning. Again, I do not have time to explore this further. I will say that neuroscience has taught us about mirror neurons, which play a significant role in our brains and in our lives. These mirror neurons help us experience the life of other people in our minds. This is another fascinating topic that deserves a whole lecture. This topic of mirror neurons is especially important as researchers continue to study autism. Some researchers seem to think that autistic persons don't have mirror neurons as non-autistic persons have them. This then would affect their ability to read faces and to empathize. But alas, I must move on. Until recent years, is there an educator anywhere that has taught us the significance and importance of outdoor life more than has Charlotte Mason? There are some issues from home education that we must address, but Mason's point of children experience in life as much as possible outdoors is a methodology that we must not lose. We lost it. And it's had devastating effect on our lives as well as on our views of nature and even the value of being in nature. She talks about the fact that a child should never learn from a book what he or she can learn directly from nature itself. I cannot even get into a discussion about the vocabulary, the geography, and on that children learn from being in nature. It is truly the second book that teaches us about God. We must never let go of this again. Narration is another principle that we cannot give up. Narration causes a convergence of many learning tools that are within the human being. For example, the idea of using thought and language, which Lev Vygotsky, another shoulder that we stand on, wrote so much about, along with our imagination as tools for learning, is a giant step forward. Add to that the images created from the text, plus the images that come from using our mirror neurons, and we, as humans, have a powerful means to know. Rote memorizing, which had been so prevalent before and during Mason's time, was and is an inefficient way to learn. Mason moved a culture that had this dependence on memorizing as a means to learn to narration, which called upon a completely different memory system. However, we know even more now in terms of various memory systems that Mason did not know. Another example, the idea of cognitive load that Dr. Spencer writes about is important to note here. Mason, however, intuitively understood this concept and shortened her lessons, thus making great strides in the learning process of children. For example, we must begin with oral narration rather than written narration, reducing the cognitive load. Even in this process of orally narrating, according to Benson and Cummins in their book, The Power of Retelling, published in 2000, children develop vocabulary, learn to sequence a story, beginning, middle, and end. Children who narrate spell better, learn sentence structure more easily, and much more. We know further that the research done in the 1980s by Brian Camborne and Hazel Brown in Australia and written about in their book, Read and Retell, also describes all the things that young people learn and develop through narrating. Again, this is another topic that is worth much more time than I can give it here. Not least of which is how we use narration with neuroatypical children. That is a whole lecture in and of itself that needs to be done. Now I want to introduce the next principle that we cannot let go of. And as a means to do that, please listen to this simple sentence and let it simmer, or let it float around in your head where you reflect, consider, cogitate, chew the cud, so to speak, sip your coffee or tea. But let your mind think about this idea over the next weeks and months. It is one of Mason's major, and to me, profound principles that we cannot let go of. Education is relationship, not power. To me, this principle flows out of the principle the child is a person. Relationship is part of our bearing the image of the Trinitarian God. We are made for relationship. It harkens back to what it means to be a human being before the fall. In a fallen world such as we live in, power is needed, and education can give you power. But our primary purpose in life is to live in relationship with God, humankind, and the physical universe. Sometimes I wonder if we thought about this more frequently, we would have less of the problems that we are having in our culture. But let's go back and look at this topic. That is, that in the garden God prepared for us and from which we continually try to escape. Again and again, we eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, telling God every time that we will assert ourselves over him and use our own power to control his world. I think this is what we are doing with some of our usages of social media. Mason's principle or theory of the science of relations is one that reaches much deeper into us and into the world around us than a fleeting moment on social media can do. But I must draw this lecture to a close, and I want to do so by reminding us that science cannot always answer our questions. A collection of data, no matter how well thought out and then collected, cannot answer our most human questions and our search for meaning. It can help. We humans are not only to be scientists, but we are to also be poets. We need not only data, but we need meaning that transcends us. Mason was not just a scientist, she was a poet. Not just a poet in the sense that she wrote poetry, but in the sense that she valued life, and particularly the life of children, beyond just the bare facts she saw in front of her. She wanted science to inform us, but she insisted on holding to what makes us human. In his book, Surprised by Meaning, Science, Faith, and How We Make Sense of Things, Alistair McGrath gives a couple of examples that explain what I mean. He describes a world in which we now live where we are bombarded with facts and data constantly. He uses an image created by the American poet Edna St. Vincent Millay, who spoke of a meteoric shower of facts. Think of all these facts as threads that are meant to be woven into a fabric, but there is no guide or help to assist in creating the fabric. One is simply left with a massive amount of threads or data without any idea as to what they mean. How do we make the fabric? What patterns will we follow? Will there even be a design? In other words, the threads are the data, but we want more. We want something meaningful. For example, a spread maybe for our dining room table that will be a thing of beauty to please us when we serve guests. In other words, we want the threads to be more than just threads or data. McGrath gives another example from Professor John Lennox, who was a mathematician and philosopher of science from Oxford. In fact, they're both from Oxford. If we analyze a cake to get an exhaustive list of the chemicals composing the cake, does this tell us why the cake was made in the first place? No. The cake could have been made to celebrate a birthday, a wedding, an anniversary. But the chemical analysis does not tell us that. If we learned by another means that the cake was made to celebrate a birthday, does that mean that our question as to why the cake was made in the first place is inconsistent with science? Of course not. Science answers questions, that is, what are the chemicals in the cake? And theology or education asks their questions, why was the cake made to begin with? My point here is that Mason sees the data, all the threads that need to be woven into a fabric, and all the chemicals that are in the cake. But she sees far more than just the data. She sees beyond the data, beyond the threads or the chemicals, into the heart, mind, and soul of the child, as a poet does who sees the world about us and expresses it in beautiful language. She gives to us not just the idea of science, but the joy, the hope, the care to live, the purpose of the cake. She sees children as persons, but she also seeks to see their individual needs. As she developed her philosophy of education and her pedagogy out of that philosophy, she grasped this wholeness of life. We must do that. We must see all children as whole human beings in need of love, food, shelter, care, and need of all the things that humans need. And we must see that they get more than data. Children need meaning in their lives. They want to know that their narrative is part of a greater narrative. They, as we, want to see the bigger meaning. Whatever the case, we, as teachers and parents, are both scientists, that is, observers of our children. But we are also poets. We inspire. We give hope. We believe in their personhood. Again, Mason led the way for us. Let me bring this lecture to a close. There are many of Mason's principles that we need to cling to. But to do so, we must consider two things. First, are we going to continue to interpret Mason by staying in the Victorian era? If we do, we will get it wrong. And the second thing we need to consider is an issue of interpretation. We cannot interpret Mason for the 21st century without doing the two things I have discussed in this lecture, and that is to dig into Mason's context and dig into current scientific thought. If we don't do these things and do them with integrity, we will mislead parents and teachers, and thus we will not bring Mason into the 21st century with the dignity and respect that she deserves. I want to end with the hope that I have for education. If we take Mason's principles and build on them using current science as she told us to do, then we can move Mason into the 21st century. And we will have much to offer our communities, our nation, and the world in terms of a fresh approach to education that will provide hope for this century. Andy and I started the Institute to take Mason's ideas into the years ahead and for all children. Using her principles and her guidance about science and the future, we, the Mason community, have an educational paradigm that will change the world. But we must not get stuck in Victorian England. Are we willing to gird up the loins of our minds and do the work necessary to make this happen as she did in her time and with the limited knowledge that she had? And may I add that we must never, just for our own sake, do it for our family. God has called us to change our families and communities and to be His mirrors and reflect His image into the world where we are to take care of His garden. We start first with ourselves, our families, but we must not stop there. We must reach the world with the healing, redemptive love of Jesus the Messiah. Charlotte Mason cannot do that. But her educational paradigm gives us a gentle, caring way to educate our children. That is one step in the direction for being a mirror that reflects the love of Jesus back into the world. Shaming and arguing on social media under the pretext of having an open conversation is not the professional way that the Institute will go about it. It will be done by how each of us shows forth the redeeming love of Jesus through our lives daily before a watching world. One last thing. The Institute is hard at work, or doing that scholarly work that I mentioned earlier, that needs to be done to bring Mason into the 21st century. We want to be thoughtful and careful with our work. We do not claim infallibility, but we do claim to work hard and to be trustworthy. While you as parents and teachers may not be able to do this hard work because just teaching your children is hard enough, the Institute will be working and planning how to do the digging we need to do to bring Mason into the 21st century. We do need financial support and support through your prayers. Your job will be to apply Mason's Principle 19. That principle leads us to pause, to think, to consider, and to reflect as we move forward. Thank you for the opportunity to share these ideas with you.